This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinians warn Israel's plan to hold the so-called flag march in Al-Quds can lead to an explosion in the situation across occupied territories. Foreign ministers of Armenia and Azerbaijan are to meet in Moscow on Friday to discuss the two countries' dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. A deal between Moscow and Kiev, which allows Ukraine to export its grain through the Black Sea, is extended for two more months. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. And now, a spokesman for the Palestinian presidency warns Israel's insistence on holding the so-called flag march will raise tensions in occupied territories. Nabil Abu Rudaina said provocative march, which is planned for this Thursday, will ignite the region and its consequences will be dire. The spokesman added Israel will be fully responsible for any escalation resulting from the march. Abu Rudaina noted occupied city of Al-Quds will remain the eternal capital of the state of Palestine. The Palestinian Hamas resistance movement also announced the march as a failed attempt by Israel to implement its plans of racist Judaization. Flag march marks Israel's occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds in 1967. The annual march is organized by far-right Israeli settlers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinian officials say latest Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip displaced more than 450 families, consisting of over 2,500 people. Coastal Territories Ministry of Social Development said the displaced Gazans include more than 1,000 children and nearly 700 women. It added more than 64% of Gaza's population suffers from food insecurity, while the poverty rate stands at 60% as a result of Israel's brutal siege. The ministry also condemned the international silence towards Israel's crimes against children of Gaza, who are direct targets of the regime's aggression. Israel attacked Gaza for 5 days starting May 9th. Onslaught claimed more than 30 lives, many of them women and children. A growing number of Israelis are now applying for passports after recent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip and retaliatory strikes by Palestinian resistance factions. In our news review segment of our bulletin earlier, we discussed what's been labeled a passport crisis and whether that bodes well for the future of the regime.
On this segment of the program, Israelis are racing to obtain passports as the regime's recent bloodshed in the Gaza Strip and Palestinians' retaliatory strikes have caused havoc among them. Israel's interior minister has called the situation a passport crisis, with reporting a major logjam of people applying for or renewing passports. It has prompted the regime to launch Operation Passport Marathon and create appointment for free passport counters, which will be operating for a month. On the first day of the operation alone, over 6,000 passports were issued. That's according to official figures. Israeli media claimed the surge in passport demands is due to the backlog caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. But a survey conducted last year showed Israelis are becoming more and more worried about their future. That's due to the growing might of Palestinian resistance forces, a cost of living crisis, and the power struggle inside Israel. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mick Napier from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Joining us from Edinburgh, also from Gaza City, we have Palestinian political activist Monty Abu Musabbeh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Napier in Edinburgh. Give us your perspective on this so-called passport crisis that Israelis are facing now.
Well, I think against a background of terrible news from Palestine, increasing cost for the Palestinians, increasing brutality and horror at the moment, a spike from the Israeli authorities, it's great to welcome some good news. And when we hear that Israelis are reaching for a second passport, we know that the morale of the Zionist bloc in Palestine has been damaged. And I've made a study of this over the years. It's quite fascinating. We hear, of course, that people, some of the settlers are leaving the occupied West Bank, which is under direct military occupation. It's important to know there are two types of settler, really. There are fanatics who believe they have a real estate deal with the deity who has given them the land. They really believe that Europeans can take anything they want in Palestine. But there are other settlers who were sent there or attracted there by very substantial economic benefits, reduced rent, all sorts of economic benefits. And some of them will be thinking now it's not worth it when Palestinian resistance is rising. So I, just to sum up, I think that, that this is a crisis of morale, and it shows that resistance can actually weaken the Israeli society, and I think it's entirely good news.
Moti Abu Mosabeh, let's bring him in on the discussion. Now, Mr. Mosabeh, has the resistance managed to rattle the morale of the Israelis?
Yeah, first of all, thanks for having me. I would like to assert on what your guest has just mentioned, that this is one of the ramifications and one of the consequences brought to the Israeli occupation by the latest Palestinian response regarding the Palestinian resistance. And no one can deny that this puts more pressure on the current hardline Israeli government. And it's another crisis, another internal crisis added to the ongoing and escalating internal crisis, simply because this current government is totally preoccupied and busy just by entrenching the occupation and trying to cement the grip on the Palestinian people, and trying just to deprive and to make sure that they are depriving the Palestinian people of having any kind of sovereign state. So this reveals clearly that the current Israeli government is not able just to handle the internal emerging issues, and it adds more evidence how fragile and weak this current government is. This is on one hand. On the other hand, it reveals clearly that the Palestinian resistance today is standing in a position that enables it to practice more pressure and to exert more pressure on the Israeli community. In this context, I would remind you that in 2021, after the battle of Saif al-Quds, confrontation between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli occupation, then it was reported that, according to the polls among the Israelis, then after that confrontation, many Israelis reported that the Israeli community literally is facing a societal rift over the ongoing and the repetitive confrontations with the Palestinian resistance. So this reveals that the response of the Palestinian resistance factions nowadays is unlike any kind of any response in the precedented years. Today, the Palestinian resistance factions are able to deter the Israeli occupation. They can actually weaken the internal situation inside the Israeli occupation, and it actually makes it very clear that the Palestinian resistance factions today can, according to the military resistance and according to the development and the enhanced abilities of the Palestinian resistance, especially in Gaza Strip, they are able to deter the Israeli occupation and to impose new realities on the Israeli occupation. So this indicates clearly that today the Palestinian people are able to confront the Israeli occupation. And on the other hand, it reveals also that this kind of connection between the Israeli settlers and this land is totally vanished, and it reveals how weak this kind of connection to this land, and it reveals clearly that the real owners of this land is the Palestinian people, because at the same time that thousands of the Israeli settlers are scrambling to take their passports, to have their passports in order to leave this land, at the same time many Palestinian or the Palestinian people, despite the ongoing and the cruel and the relentless Israeli aggression and the Israeli airstrikes that leveled their houses to the ground. We have witnessed that many Palestinians shown high steadfastness in this regard, and they were sending messages of defiance and messages of challenge to the Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli brutality.
Sure.
So, yes, putting these two senses and comparing these senses together actually indicates clearly that the Palestinian people today are standing defiantly on their land. At the same time, the Israelis and the Israeli settlers are scrambling to leave this land.
All right, that's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Thanks to Mr. McNapier joining us from Edinburgh, and thanks to Moti Abu Musape from Gaza City.
And welcome back, everyone. And the foreign ministers of Armenia and Azerbaijan are to meet in Moscow to discuss a decades-long dispute over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson said the meeting, which will also be attended by the Russian Foreign Minister, will take place on May 19th. Maria Zakharova added the trilateral talks are expected to focus on a draft peace treaty. This after early Wednesday, Armenia said that one of its soldiers was killed after Azeri forces opened fire at the two countries' common border. Azerbaijan dismissed the accusation as a lie. On Sunday, Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev met in Brussels for a new round of talks. Another meeting between Pashinyan and Aliyev is slated for June 1st in Moldova and expected to involve the French President Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. A deal between Moscow and Kiev that allows Ukraine to export its grain through the Black Sea has been extended for two more months. The extension was announced by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He hailed Ukraine, Russia, and the UN for their cooperation. Moscow also confirmed the renewal. Earlier, the Kremlin had threatened, though, not to agree to the extension due to Western sanctions against Russia, arguing that the restrictive measures have hindered Moscow's own farm exports. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has lauded the extension, saying that it is essential for overcoming global food insecurity.
These agreements matter for global food security. Ukrainian and Russian products feed the world. Under the Black Sea Initiative, more than 10 million tons of food have been exported. Vital food supplies are reaching some of the world's most vulnerable people and places, including 30,000 tons of wheat that just left Ukraine aboard a WFP chartered ship to feed hungry people in Sudan. Some positive and significant developments.
Guterres, however, said outstanding issues remain, expressing hope a comprehensive agreement can be reached. Ukraine grain deal was initially brokered by Turkey and the UN in July last year to help tackle a global food crisis that has been exacerbated in the face of the Ukraine war. Now the Ukrainian military says it's made new advances near the eastern city of Bakhmut in heavy fighting with Russian forces. Ukraine's military spokesperson said the country's forces have successfully conducted a defensive operation, penetrating up to 500 meters in some parts. The official, however, noted Russian forces are seeking to take over the city at will, striking Ukrainians with all systems and calibers. He added Russia is moving new units to Bakhmut in an attempt to achieve some kind of intermediate success. Bakhmut has been the focal point of fighting between Russia and Ukraine for about 10 months now. The city is seen by Moscow as a stepping stone towards capturing the rest of the eastern industrial region of Donbas, which borders Russia. The European Union's foreign policy chief has asked for 3.5 billion euros to be added to a fund that is used to finance military aid for Ukraine. EU sources said that Josep Borrell has asked EU members to raise a financial ceiling for this fund, known as the European Peace Facility. The fund has already allocated some 4.6 billion euros in military aid to Ukraine. Now, Borrell's proposal has to be first approved by EU governments. U.S. and its Western allies have been pumping massive amounts of money and military hardware into Ukraine since the war with Russia began last year. Moscow's time and again warned that the West's military aid will only prolong the war.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Britain and secured pledges for more military equipment from London, including air defense missiles and long-range attack drones. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak also expressed support for giving Ukraine Western-made fighter jets. According to Sunak's office, the attack drones have a range of over 200 kilometers. Zelensky's visit came after the UK became the first NATO country to provide Kyiv with a long-range cruise missile known as the Storm Shadow that can hit targets up to 250 kilometers away. The UK's pledge to send more arms to Kyiv drew an angry response from Moscow.
We view this extremely negatively. The United Kingdom aspires to be at the forefront of those countries that continue to pump Ukraine with weapons. Once again, this cannot have any significant and fundamental impact on the course of the special military operation, but it certainly leads to further destruction, further retaliation, and so on. So for Ukraine, this story is being made much more complicated.
Zelensky inquired with the British about the possibility of Ukraine receiving Western-made fighter jets. Zelensky said after his meeting with Sunak, he was feeling very positive about creating a jets coalition, which he expects to happen in the closest time. While Ukraine has yet to receive a promise of Western aircraft, the British are laying the groundwork for the eventuality. According to a statement by the British Prime Minister's office, London will commence an elementary flying phase for cohorts of Ukrainian pilots to learn basic training this summer, adding, "This training goes hand in hand with UK efforts to work with other countries on providing F-16 jets that are Ukraine's fighter jets of choice." Sunak said he would help rally other countries to send fighter jets.
Other countries are involved. I'm talking to those leaders. I'll be doing more of that this week in my international engagements. We're very keen to build that coalition of countries to give Volodymyr and his people the aircraft support they need.
Zelensky's visit to Britain wrapped up a tour of Europe, Italy, Germany, France, Great Britain. While in France, Zelensky met with President Emmanuel Macron and was promised more light tanks and armored vehicles. In Germany, Zelensky and Chancellor Olaf Scholz discussed a massive $2.9 billion weapons package that Berlin has announced for Kyiv.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Despite the White House's rhetoric about supporting global democracy, the U.S. regime sold weapons in 2022 to 57% of the world's authoritarian regimes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept reported, since President Joe Biden came to office in 2021, he has described a battle between democracies and autocracies in which the U.S. and other democracies strive to create a peaceful world. The reality, however, is that the Biden administration has helped increase the military power of a large number of authoritarian countries. According to an Intercept review of recently released government data, the U.S. regime sold weapons to at least 57% of the world's autocratic countries in 2022. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been the world's biggest weapons dealer, accounting for about 40% of all arms exports in a given year. In general, these exports are funded through grants or sales. There are two pathways for the latter category: foreign military sales and direct commercial sales. The U.S. regime acts as an intermediary for FMS acquisitions. It buys the material from a company first and then delivers the goods to the foreign recipient. DCS acquisitions are more straightforward. They are the result of an agreement between a U.S. company and a foreign government. Both categories of sales require the government's approval. Country-level data for last year's DCS authorizations was released in late April through the U.S. State Department's Directorate of Defense Trade Controls. FMS figures for fiscal year 2022 were released earlier this year through the Pentagon's Defense Security Cooperation Agency. According to their data, a total of 142 countries and territories bought weapons from the U.S. in 2022 for a total of $85 billion in bilateral sales. How many of those countries were democracies and how many were autocracies? That question can be answered by comparing the new U.S. arms sales data to political regime data from the Varieties of Democracy project at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, which uses a classification system that's called Regimes of the World. The system classifies regimes into four categories: closed autocracy, electoral autocracy, electoral democracy, and liberal democracy. For a country to be classified as a democracy, it must have multi-party elections and political freedoms that make those elections meaningful. According to this methodology, the dividing line between democracies and autocracies is whether a country's leaders are accountable to their citizens through free and fair elections. Of the 84 countries codified as autocracies under the regimes of the world system in 2022, the United States sold weapons to at least 48 or 57% of them. The "at least" qualifier is necessary because several factors frustrate the accurate tracking of U.S. weapon sales. The U.S. State Department's report of commercial arms sales during the fiscal year makes the prodigious use of various in its recipients category. As a result, the specific recipient for nearly $11 billion in weapon sales are not disclosed. The regimes of the world system is just one of the several indices that measure democracy worldwide, but running the same analysis with other popular indices produces similar results. For example, Freedom Home listed 195 countries, and for each one labeled whether it qualified as an electoral democracy in its annual Freedom in the World report. of the 85 countries Freedom House did not designate as an electoral democracy. The United States sold weapons to 49 or 58% of them in fiscal year 2022. These findings contradict Biden's preferred framing of international politics as fundamentally a struggle in which the world's democracies, led by the U.S., are on the side of peace and security, as he called it in last year's State of the Union address. Opposing the United States and its democratic allies are the autocracies that collude to undermine the international system, Biden has claimed. In a speech in Warsaw last year, he said the battle between democracy and autocracy is one between liberty and repression, and between a rules-based international order and one governed by brute force. The White House's 2022 National Security Strategy adds, "The most pressing strategic challenge facing our vision is from powers that layer authoritarian governance with a revisionist foreign policy." Despite that rhetoric, a review of the new data suggests instead a business-as-usual approach to weapon sales. Former President Donald Trump based his arms sales policy primarily on economic considerations, corporate interest above all else. In Biden's first full fiscal year as president, weapon sales from the United States to other countries reached $206 billion, according to the State Department's annual tally, which uses an opaque but seemingly broader accounting of yearly FMS and DCS figures. Biden's first year total surpasses the Trump-era high of $192 billion. The multi-billion-dollar effort to train and equip Ukraine doesn't fully explain the dramatic rise in total arms sales last year, let alone to autocracies. Rather, the new figures reveal the continuity between Republican and Democratic administrations in the United States. While Biden signaled early on that his arms sales policy would be based primarily on strategic and human rights considerations, not just economic interests, he broke from that policy not too long after entering office by approving weapon sales to authoritarian regimes.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Sohail Sarani. Brother Sohail, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program Viewpoints in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. When you get to the text of Nahjul Balagha and through the character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, you want to know Islam, I think you have an authentic source now. But when you get to Nahjul Balagha and the very character of Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you can find how practical could a person be and be obedient to his master, that is Allah, and then the Prophet of Allah, that is Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
This is unfortunately what is missed in today's world, you know. When we want to refer into the interpretation of Islam, we start from the various scholars that live in our contemporary time.
You know, in one of the tradition, I would paraphrase that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that know the truth and you will know the people of truth.
Mm-hmm. People
so,
of truth,
so
that's right.
There's the right methodology of knowing, looking at Islam, that you need to know the truth,
mm-hmm.
and then you will know who were on truth and who were those personalities.
That's
and
right.
Very rightly mentioned in one of the tradition, we also see that, and again I'm paraphrasing, where our Holy Infallible Alayhi Wasallam says, if you present our sayings and our teachings to people as they are, then the beauty of them would make people follow us. You know, so that's very obvious. Like when you present the content to the world, and they will definitely, you know, Rehber also mentions in one of his speeches that those who are criticizing Islam, or those who have some issue, and then they are pinpointing each and everything about Islam.
That's all right.
Before doing that, I would like to tell them, and he clearly mentioned that, you know, go and tell my words to them. Go and say them, tell this to them, those who are like, you know, in the Reformation, quote-unquote, like they call
That's
it,
right.
call themselves as reformative camp or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Go between them. And, you know, tell them that, you know, before doing this criticism, read once this book, Najul Balagha, and then see if you can criticize.
That's all right. Brother Ali.
Yeah.
Any comments?
I just want to take this opportunity to say one word to the brothers or sisters who are listening to us, and to say that in case, I'm talking to all the Muslim brothers, whatever they are and wherever they live, whether they are, for example, follower of the Ahlul Bayt or not. They are from Shia or Sunni brothers and sisters. I want to tell them, if they want to look at the history of Islam in a just manner, by a just person, I just want to recommend them to read this book of Nahj al-Balagha. Actually, Nahj al-Balagha, the importance of history is quite clear to everybody, that if you work in the history, specifically the history of Islam, actually it works like a torch of guidance for you. So it's good to know the history of Islam first. But if you want to, for example, regardless of what faith or what sect you are following or what your beliefs are, just see this book and read this book and see if the person who is actually talking to you and narrating the history of his time is just or not.
In fact, many of the Ahlul Sunnah brothers and sisters, they also believe that Imam Ali was the most,
knowledgeable,
highest rank sahaba of Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah,
Islam.
That's mentioned.
So,
definitely,
yeah.
They know that he was among the virtuous and let's say the most excellent companion of the Holy Prophet. But I want to invite them to look at this companion of the Holy Prophet with another glasses, with a new eye. Because
from a new perspective.
From a new perspective, actually. Here we see Imam Ali alayhi salam, to some extent, when he actually talks to you, he talks about the history of that time. He talks about the policies that a Muslim leader needs to take at the time that he is the leader of the Islamic Ummah. Why? Because we are in need of knowing what happened at the dawn of Islam. And history will help us. As I said, it is a torch of guidance for us. And we are in need of knowing our background, our history, to see what happened to us and what... So by this, actually, we are preventing any other probable damage that might come to Islam and Islam world. So here we are actually immunizing and guaranteeing the safety of the Islamic Ummah. So when we understand that, what is the duty of a duty bound? What is the duty of a Muslim at the time that he lives? Because the leader of the Islam, because the Islamic leader tells you what's your obligations and what's your commitments in the Islam world. And beautifully, Imam Ali alayhi salam actually portrays the duties of a Muslim at his time, and it is working till today.
And it is not only beneficial for the Muslim lands, but the non-Muslim lands too.
Mm-hmm.
because there are some speeches and the words in Nahjul Balagha which are addressed to the humanity and the human beings in general.
Brother, when a true word is being said, it doesn't matter who is your adversary,
yes,
whether it is a Muslim.
I do want to say even the non-Muslims
but since,
can benefit from
why
this
did
book.
I actually address my Muslim brothers and sisters as my audience? Because
yes,
they know about Imam Ali. At least
yeah,
they have heard of him.
Yes.
But for anyone with any taste that yes, wants to look at Nahjul Balagha, he's free to come and take from this ocean.
You know what is the interesting point is that when ISIS was established in Iraq and Syria, when you look at what they did, and when you refer to Nahjul Balagha of Imam Ali talking about the Kharijites, you can see the very much same significance, characteristics among them of the people who are...
Exactly, that's interestingly you mentioned how Rehber says in
yes,
one of his speeches, he says like during today's time,
mm-hmm,
we have one slogan all over, you can listen to the slogan. It's a similar slogan, but then the directions are so different from each other. Direction of Muslim countries
yes,
and Muslim groups
yes,
are so different from each other that it's very high time that we need a guideline and, you know, the Nahjul Balagha can play that part of torch-bearing things for us in today's time because he drew parallel between that time and the time we are
that's
living
right,
now.
And this time.
Yeah.
That's all right.
And you know,
okay,
just wanted to add this as well because he mentions very nicely, he says, it gives you two very important, you know, takeaway from Nahjul Balagha.
Mm-hmm.
And the first part is your foundational, core foundation of Islamic viewpoint or worldview. You know, how your tawhid is, how you
yes,
look at Nabuwat,
yes,
how you like look at prophethood and such, right? And then, more importantly, another part is the implementation in your practical life.
That's right.
So that's what you take out from Nahjul Balagha because
okay,
Imam Ali lived up to that life
mm-hmm,
and he practically lived as well as he, you know, mentioned everything during his various occasions. He delivered those sermons and letters to different people during his 4 years or, you know, about 5 years government.
That's all right. Brother Ali, is this book, unreadable in some of the Muslim lands? I mean, is it forbidden to read?
No, I haven't seen anywhere to see it, for example, banned or, I don't know, to be forbidden in any, at least I have not seen anything like that, or I have not yet heard of it.
Okay.
But the problem is that it is not known to Muslims. This book mm, is not that, I mean, the book.
You know what is the question? The question is that maybe for the Muslim lands, this book and the people around the world, I mean, even Muslims, Nahjul Balagha is considered like the other books of Ahadith.
Yeah.
Like what we have of Bukhari and Muslim among the Sunni,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
And so many books of Ahadith among the Shia ones. Maybe this book is looked as a mere, we can say, akhbari or we can say a narrative book.
So I wish it was seen as a, for example, hadith book among them, and it was known as a hadith book
mm-hmm,
among the Muslims. But the problem is that this book is not that known among the
mm-hmm,
Muslims. They have not heard of it. For example, I remember once I talked to some scholars from in Islam world earlier. When I was referring to Nahjul Balagha, he was asking me what Nahjul Balagha is. So it seems that we have not, actually we as Muslims and specifically the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, have not yet worked a lot to introduce this book to humanity. So it is our duty to do our share and to do our duty and to propagate and promote this book to humankind, not, and specifically the Muslims who know Imam Ali alayhi salam, at least as some as the leader of the Islamic Command right after the Prophet, and some at least as the Khalifa of the Holy Prophet. So they know Imam Ali alayhi salam to some extent, and it's more understandable for them if we tell them that this is the book that has been collected from sayings of Imam.
That's right.
But unfortunately, the problem is that it is even not understood. Brother, let the whole world aside, but those who claim to be the follower of Imam inside the
yeah,
country,
to
what extent are people actually are familiar with Nahjul Balagha? In some of our families and houses, we have not yet even one copy of it at home.
Mm-hmm.
So when a Christian scholar like George Jordaq reads it 200 times, and he is still thirsty of reading it more, 220, some, if I'm not mistaken. And he's still thirsty of reading it more. It means that I have not yet understood the importance and the value of this book to make it that important for me, for my family. To read it, for example, in daily or weekly or monthly basis for my children.
That's
or
right.
To teach it at the schools. It is not even yet being taught at the schools in this Muslim country.
Yeah,
that
for
we
the young
are
generation.
It's true that in some schools, actually, there are some competitions from some sermons or some words, but it is not a textbook for our students.
Or have
yet.
Not been translated to different languages.
Unfortunately, okay. It has not. Into English, I know it has been translated, yeah. But the translation, it's not good to be actually broadcasted, but they are very poor. Actually, translations of Najwa are not as good as translations which have been made on Quran.
That's right.
But I think it's good to invite those who are able to come and invest at least on the translation of this great and important book. And it's good to be translated into different languages to different people, not only to the languages which are being talked and are accents in Islam world. No, to different languages it has to be translated, inshallah.
Al-Imam Ali alayhi salam, Sotul Adalatul Insaniya. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the voice of the human justice.
Very true.
This
George
is the title of the book of George Jordak. We can say which was also translated into Persian language and also English language. And as you said, George Jordak, after writing so many times the Nahjul Balagha, got understood that Ali is the symbol of justice for all the Muslims around the world. And this is the important point. We can say if one truly research and search into the content of Nahjul Balagha, he can be familiar with the true picture of Islam and the true successor to Prophet Muhammad, and this is very important.
Inshallah.
Okay, Brother Suhaib, we got about 2-3 minutes. 1 minute? 1-2 minutes for your final remarks?
Finally, I would like to, reiterate the same thing that as Brother Ali said. When you look at the statements of Imam Khamenei and the lot of emphasis that he puts on Nahjul Balagha, I mean, I myself feel that, I should, beside, like, we have a habit of reciting Quran during month of Ramadan.
Yes.
We should also have, like, one or two iterations of reading Nahjul Balagha as
That's
well.
Right. Very good.
And inshallah, we get tawfiq that during this leftover, we can use the best of, we can make the best use of our time and, dwell into this precious gem, inshallah.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Brother Sohail.
Thank you.
And Brother Ali for your presence in the program Viewpoints.
Thanks to you, brother.
The Book of Nahjul Balagha, compiled by Sayyida Razi, may Allah bless him. He was really a great scholar and author. He has also so many other books. But among, what a tawfiq Sayyida Razi had to select and to, we can say, compile Nahjul Balagha. And, in the house of the Shias, whenever you look, you can say in the bookshelf, beside the Holy Quran, there is one volume of Nahjul Balagha. And this is very important, okay? The point and the tawfiq that this scholar, Sayyida Razi, had. May Allah bless his soul and also his brother, Sharif al-Murtadha. Two great brothers who, we can say, were the source of benefit for the upcoming generations of the scholars after themselves. So this is our program on Nahjul Balagha, as was addressed by the leader of Iran on different occasions, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. For more information on this program and on other episodes, you can visit our website at parstudio.com/Ian Call of Islam Radio, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The latest government statistical data in England show that the price of food has risen sharply. The continuation of this situation has put the focus on food insecurity in Britain. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Experts have warned slashing the cost of food, fruit and vegetables to ease the cost of living crisis should be on the table at Downing Street's food summit in the coming days. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is facing calls to urge supermarkets to halve what they charge amid stubbornly high inflation rates. Retailers have privately told ministers that food prices have peaked and will start to fall significantly in the coming months. But that will do little to help those battling soaring bills, with warnings even middle-class families are struggling. Farmers, retailers and others from across the UK food chain have been invited to a summit at No. 10 Downing Street. The meeting was reportedly brought forward after food inflation hit another high last month. Professor Tim Lang, a former government advisor, said one message that Prime Minister Rishi Sunak could deliver at the meeting was, he could say, right, I want you to halve the prices on key fruit, vegetable and hydrocarbons like potatoes. The British government's former food czar, Henry Dimbleby, stated that politicians need to be making fruit and vegetable much cheaper for those who can't afford it. Official figures put food and drink price inflation at more than 19.2% in the year to March, almost twice the overall headline inflation rate. The hikes have been given by soaring energy costs and disruption to the supply chain caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Rising wages, difficult weather conditions which have affected harvests and trade barriers caused by Brexit have all been blamed as factors for rising cost of living. Professor Tim Lang said he was part of a cost of living commission in a London borough which had heard evidence of people going without meals for days. He also warned of what he said was the worsening affordability of even middle-class people to eat a decent diet. The government's former food czar, Henry Dimbleby, stated that he backed a targeted approach, adding, you need to direct support at the families who are really struggling. Dimbleby warned that it would not be right for the better off to also receive subsidised fruit and vegetables. His recommendations to the government included a community Eat Well programme, designed to support those on low incomes to improve their diets. Experts warn any changes to the UK supply chain will take time to affect consumers. Prices are already a source of tension between supermarkets and the farmers who produce much of what they see on their shelves. According to reports, the No. 10 Downing Street event will feature speeches and breakout sessions on key themes. There will also be a showcase of Great British food and drink businesses and innovators. A government spokesperson said, "Our UK Farm to Fork Summit will bring together government and representatives from across the food supply chain to step up cooperation and promote all elements of our world-renowned farming and food industries." The government spokesperson added, "The event will look at how we can champion UK food and drink both at home and abroad by boosting confidence, helping more businesses to invest in domestic food production, and supporting the long-term resilience and sustainability of the UK food sector." Bloomberg News Agency has also covered this story and tells us more. According to a report, rising grocery prices in the UK have replaced energy as the main inflationary concern for the Bank of England. Although energy prices have slightly declined, British families are facing a tight squeeze on their finances due to double-digit inflation. Low- and middle-income families are being hit the hardest, given that they spend the bulk of their income on essentials and are now seeing a dramatic increase in their shopping bills. According to the Bank of England, food inflation has been particularly high, reaching 19.1% in March. Over the past year, grocery price growth in the United Kingdom has been at its highest level since records began. According to Bloomberg News Agency, it has now replaced energy costs as the most important financial issue for the public. The Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, told reporters recently, "We're acutely aware of how difficult this rise in food prices is for people, especially for those on lower incomes." Andrew Bailey added, "I expect food price inflation to start slowing down soon, but I admit that it is taking longer than we previously thought." Meanwhile, economists say it has become difficult to argue where prices will go at a time of major supply disruptions caused by the conflict in Ukraine in today's modern interconnected world. According to the Bloomberg News Agency, this has meant that Bank of England lacks past experience for making food price forecasts. The Bank of England's recent monetary policy report said the sustained higher price level represents a long-term cost for households and businesses, and this is one driver of subdued economic activity over the forecast horizon. According to Bloomberg, even with lower energy costs, it will take time for food producers such as farmers, who often buy key supplies like fertilizers in advance, to adjust prices and make their goods more affordable to consumers. The British newsletter The Morning Star has also covered this story and tells us more. New research suggests that 1 in 3 young people say their family have relied on food banks or other community outlets for supplies in recent months. The co-op and children's charity Barnardo's said their study of 5,000 individuals between the ages of 10 and 25 found the stark impact the cost of living crisis was having on the access to food and mental well-being of young people and children. The report said almost half of young people have worried about being able to afford things in the past 6 months, with 1 in 3 saying their family has used food support, such as a community fridge or a food bank. Almost 1 in 4 said they have started the day without a meal. The study also found that the rising cost of living is having a significant knock-on impact on young people's life goals, as making it through day by day takes priority. The report said having enough money to cover basic needs has become the most common aspiration for most young people, overtaking other traditional goals such as achieving their dream job or buying a house. Only 2 in 4 of those surveyed said they believe it is likely they will be able to have enough money to cover basic needs in the future. Shirin Khourihaq, chief executive of Co-op Group, says, "The cost of living has had a seismic impact on young people, with many having to prioritize immediate needs, like where their next meal will come from, over long-term goals and their aspirations." Shirin Khourihaq added, "Remarkably, despite all of this, young people continue to show resilience and ambition to create a better future, but all too often they're cut out of important discussions and policy-making decisions that directly impact them." She added, "We know that taking a grassroots approach and giving young people a voice on the issues which affect them will drive better long-term outcomes for them and their communities." Lynn Perry, chief executive of the charity Barnardo's, said, "We know from our frontline work supporting children and families across the United Kingdom that too many are struggling to access the very basics, including food, and there's an increasing impact on their mental well-being and opportunities. Lynn Perry added, "Worryingly, and new research with Co-op shows that young people seem to be losing hope and do not feel optimistic about their future."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.